Welcome back to Word and Table, a weekly podcast about liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship and why it is vital in our world today. I'm your host, Alex Wilgus, and I am back, as usual, with Father Stephen Gauthier. Welcome back, Father Stephen.
Good to be back, Alex.
Father Stephen is the canon theologian of the Diocese of the Upper Midwest in the Anglican Church in North America. And Father Stephen, I wanted to talk to you today about Anglicanism, ask you about it, rather. You know, our podcast kind of has a larger scope than just Anglicanism, but you and I are both in the Anglican Church of North America, to be precise. And but today, yeah, I just wanted to talk a little bit, ask you a couple of questions about our tradition and what makes it distinct. There's so much history and so many figures and so many distinctives that we can talk about with Anglicanism. But today, I just want to start with a couple of questions. So don't think of this episode as an exhaustive account of Anglicanism. But I just want to start with a couple of questions. And the first one is one that I often get from my evangelical friends who come to an Anglican church for the first time. And they come out saying, gosh, it's so Catholic. It feels so Catholic. There's the priests and deacons, and we have bishops and all the robes, and a lot of the dress looks similar. So, but it's an interesting question, Stephen. You know, as Anglicans, what are we? Are we Protestant or are we Catholic?
Well, we are both. That's sort of a unique position to be in this sense, is that if you think at the time of the Reformation, one side you're emphasizing the historic continuity of the church, as found in its orders and across time, the Church of the Creeds and the Councils, emphasizing that historic connection, also emphasizing our sacramental life. And the Church of England, that's what we mean by the Anglican Church. The Anglican Church means the Church has always been in England. You know, it has a history, but it's long precedes the Reformation. We often use Anglicanism to describe the Church simply since the Reformation, but mm-hmm. It was always the Anglican Church. Just okay. As in France, people in French history, for example, talk about the Gallican Church.
Okay.
You know, it had its own life. The church in France had a life of its own. It had a relationship to the church in Rome. It was part of, it was a connection, but it very much was had a life of its own. Uh-huh. So what we have is, to the extent that even through the Reformation, we insisted on a historical connection to the Catholic faith in the sense of the Church of the Councils, the Church of the Creeds, mm-hmm. the three orders of ministry, and sacramental life. But we are also very much a Church of the Reformed, which we often use the word Protestant. Mm-hmm. We absolutely agreed in the primacy of Scripture as the sole basis for, you know, everything necessary for salvation is to be found in the Scriptures of the Old and New Testament, Scriptura Sola. Mm-hmm. Mind you, read together at the undivided church, but nonetheless, Scriptura Sola is the foundation of faith. And the idea that the essence of our faith is we are justified by our faith, justification by faith. So I think sometimes people use the term for via media, the middle way. I don't really like the term because it sounds like a lowest common denominator.
So you mean like a middle the way. Idea that the Anglican Church is kind of in the middle between Protestant and Catholic and kind of
a
way a of reconciling way. The two? Okay,
a yeah. third way. And what I don't like about it is I think it really doesn't do justice because that could sound like a reductionism, a lowest common denominator.
Okay.
Whereas I think it's actually the opposite. I think Anglicanism reaches out to the fullness of both sides. It is truly Catholic, and it is truly Reformed. It's a Reformed Catholic Church in England is our ideal.
Okay.
Fully Catholic and fully Reformed.
So, but that whole Reformation thing did happen, right?
Yes, so, certainly did.
So let's talk about the Reformation. What happened in England at the Reformation?
Well, maybe we should talk first of what happened in Europe at the time of the Reformation. A lot of things are, a lot of dissatisfaction was coming across in European life about the church. Mm-hmm. Everyone agrees. There's no disagreement anywhere. Especially within the Roman Church, and the need in the Western Church for reform.
Okay.
There certainly was a need for reform. So that's a universal that was given. The question is, what nature would that reform take? And there are a number of challenges that might help our listeners to that might be unaware of. One thing, for example, is in the late Middle Ages, when we come to this time, we have a whole new class of people who are really arising, a very powerful class, a moneyed middle class, the bourgeoisie, right? Basically moneyed city class, mm-hmm. you know, of people who make money in a profoundly different way than people had made in the past, and they're a powerful force. And because of their money, they're getting educations. We have the introduction of movable type, et cetera. People are more demanding about their religious faith. In a sense, as people have these opportunities and things, people are asking hard questions.
Okay.
You know, everyone knew that reform was necessary, but there are hard questions here. But part of that would be the increased group of people with a direct interest, other than professional religious.
Okay.
You know, a whole middle class who had a serious interest in faith.
So all of a sudden, people sitting in your pews in your parish are asking you pretty tougher theological questions than you're used to as a priest.
I think you have more of that. Another thing that we would have, for example, would be there are a lot of institutional crisis in the church. One of the things we have, for example, with religious orders and the like, is there would be a difficulty. Religious orders have their ups and downs as far as over history.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of the Reformation, we're in a down period. There are many fine religious people, don't get me wrong here. But what we also had is the social role. Two things would happen, often caused a scandal. One would be is that people would donate money to, let's say, to a monastery. Uh-huh. And let's say that the monastery used to have 200 monks.
Okay.
Well, you know, that was 150 years ago. Now we have five left, but they're still sitting on all that money.
Okay, got it.
You know, et cetera. There was a sense of the disproportionality of ecclesiastical resources. It often caused a scandal.
Okay.
To people, you know.
So you might have a monastery over here with not very many monks in it, but it's still sitting on a pile of cash, and then you got a parish over here serving a ton more people, and they're dirt poor, right, or something like that.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Also, you had trouble with basically in the religious life. You have to remember that at this time, people had to, how do you put it, had to basically park extra children and the like.
Okay.
Like unmarriageable daughters. It costs money to marry your daughter, et cetera, when you're talking about the upper classes, the middle classes.
So what do you do with the extras?
Extra daughters, extra sons.
So so what you're saying is that at this point there wasn't exactly a job market as we know it, that you should go to college, get a job. No, it didn't work like that.
Your parents would place you.
Okay.
You could go into the nobility, with a son, you go into the military, et cetera, but that's only so many. Basically, extra sons and things often were put into the religious life, et cetera.
Sure.
But we also had part of our problem could be is some people went into religious life with minimal vocations.
Mm.
They weren't necessarily irreligious, but even in religious orders, in convents, for example, we think of Teresa of Avila, the great reformer in the Carmelite order. It wasn't that that the convent of the Incarnation, for example, was a sinkhole of vice. These were good women.
Yeah.
It was more like a sorority house. When you hear the descriptions of the fact is not surprising, so that most of these women were sort of parked there.
Okay.
They went to mass, they said the office, but a lot of their other time they spent visiting with people from town.
So you're saying they weren't exactly taking it real seriously, the whole religious life aspect of it.
Well, they weren't professionally. They tried to do their job, as it were, but they weren't particularly necessarily
impassioned, called.
Right. Now, this was not always true. There were some remarkably devout saints,
okay, sure.
Teresa, et cetera, of course. But the point is there are a lot of these. It's up and down. It's you have these kind of things that cause scandal. We have multiplicity of posts. Some people often had multiple different posts. Imagine if you had people who are having several different posts to combine salaries.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You know, this is happening. So you have a lot of these kind of abuses.
Okay, yeah.
So all of these things are sort of coming, but everyone agrees that there's a need, and there are doctrinal problems, frankly, that come from a lot of folk religion had crept in, how people looked at things. And so everyone agrees something needs to be done. Now, in our particular case in England, the operative factor for this is going to be a strange dynastic problem.
Hmm.
You know, one of the things we can take as a given, one of the joys of living in the modern age has been, like in a modern democracy, is we take the transition of power as an automatic thing. We don't have to worry about civil wars and things and violence,
right,
and things.
Go out and vote. And
when we have elections and things, that this has been one of our, an amazing thing when you look at human history. In monarchies, a question as to who would succeed could lead to wars. It would be the dynastic struggles that involved everybody. Wars really were pretty awful.
Yeah.
England, for example, had gone through the War of the Roses and things over a dynastic struggle.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there because I know where this is going. Right, we're about to get into Henry VIII. Because yeah. this,
indeed,
this was going to be my next question, Stephen, and there's no getting around it. But the next one I always get is, "Oh, Anglicans, isn't that the church that simply existed to give Henry VIII the divorce?" Right.
Yeah, there's no getting around Henry. He's no one's proud of Henry. I've got to tell you that we don't. You're not going to see windows in Anglican churches celebrating Henry.
Uh-huh.
However, to understand, you know, what happened here, and then to see how sometimes good can come out of bad, is what originally motivated Henry. Later on, goes we know it's the famous six wives of Henry VIII, etc. But that's not what happened originally with the famous divorce. What happened with the divorce is Henry, first of all, it's sort of an odd situation. He had an older brother, Arthur, who was supposed to be king.
Uh-huh.
He's one of those junior varsity children.
Okay.
His brother was the one who
placed kids.
Yeah. So actually, he did theological training.
Oh.
So he actually knew something. It's quite serious. He wrote a book for which he received the title Defender of the Faith.
Wow.
Called Defense of the Seven Sacraments. Huh. And the kings and queens of England to this day retain the title Defender of the Faith.
For the king or the queen.
Yeah. Yes, from that. And when people claim, well, no, he had that. He actually had some real theological training. It was no theology, but he was serious training, though. Is that people might remember from Thomas More's trial, for example, if you've ever seen A Man for All Seasons. Where Thomas More, when he was accused of writing that book, he said, uh-huh. It is from first to last the king's book.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But the point with Henry was that Arthur dies.
Mm.
Now, we know marriages weren't love matches when it came to kings. One of the disadvantages of being a king is your spouse would pretty much be chosen for political necessity.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way you bound alliances, you bound houses together.
Sure.
And so Arthur was married to one of the most eligible women in Europe, as far as this way, was Catherine of Aragon.
Mm-hmm.
So when Arthur dies, leaving his widow, how do we maintain that alliance? Is she, the trouble was she was his brother's wife.
Mm.
So what do we do about that? You're not supposed to marry your brother's widow.
Yeah.
That's one of the commandments in the Torah, right? That's one of the prohibited degrees. You don't marry your, remember, we have John the Baptist.
Yeah.
You know, talking about, that's your brother's wife. You can't marry, but mind you, he was still alive. But in any event, that you can't, I believe he was still alive. But the point is, this was an issue. But what happened is he got a dispensation from Rome. And the grounds for the dispensation of how could he marry was that the marriage had never been consummated with Arthur.
Mm.
They had been married, but they never actually lived together as man and wife.
Oh, okay.
He died before that could happen.
Yeah.
And so the argument that was a basis of declaring the marriage null, which allowed him.
Okay.
Now, he can't produce a male heir.
Okay, yeah.
Now, unfortunately, knowing as little as they did about biology, they assumed
that was
the wife's fault.
Yeah.
But he honestly thought, and also, because in the books of Moses, it actually talks about one of the punishments of, you know, violating this would be, you know, not producing heirs. So he actually, in all sincerity, came to actually believe that that he was being punished for that the church had authorized him to do something it shouldn't have authorized him to do.
Mm.
But regardless, politically, there's a strong motivation. We've got to do something to produce a male heir.
Otherwise,
because especially a woman being in line of succession wouldn't be the obvious thing of our day. Could seriously result in people trying to move in, push her out,
right,
and put someone else on the throne.
Right.
So what basically happens, we could, some other show, when people are really, really tired and want to get some sleep, we could talk about some of the details. It's actually a fascinating story.
Yeah.
But what really happens, though, is those are the practical reasons that lead to the break with Rome.
Uh-huh.
You know, over this is the divorce. Rome will not grant the divorce. It has to balance things on the continent. There are issues about questioning its dispensation, but it does not give the divorce. It's being leaned on by Catherine's brother.
Okay.
On the other side. At one time, I believe he actually occupied Rome. Okay,
wow.
Not for that reason, but the point would be is a lot of people thought this is a good time with the break anyway to really reevaluate the relationship.
Okay.
And two things I should say here. As we said, the national churches were much more independent than we would think. For example, the church in France called the Gallican Church had considerable autonomy from Rome.
Mm.
They were Roman Catholics. They never broke from the Church of Rome. However, the church had a separate life of its own. For example, when the Council of Trent meets, the decrees cannot be put into place. It has no power legally to enact decrees until they're approved by the King of France.
He has
to approve them before they can be implemented in France. So we have that issue. Also, the idea of the state getting involved in cleaning up the church is a pretty old Christian idea from this, sadly. Hmm. Remember Constantine? Why do we have the Council of Nicaea? Is there's division in the church. The empire wants this to be a source of unity. And believe it's sort of its duty. If you're the Christian prince,
you're coming into
the part of your responsibility is help to protect the church.
Yeah.
Remember Charlemagne was involved in church reforms to help the church, live its life better, to clean things up, to help with liturgy and things. This was considered a sort of natural thing. Kings did have a history of being involved.
Okay.
So we'd strike us as odd today.
Right.
Rightly so. But back then that would not have been considered odd.
Okay.
The extent to which government would think of somehow getting involved, if you are the Christian King of England, that you would actually, as part of your responsibility, be some connection with the well-being of the church in England.
Okay, I see. So
that would have been a more natural idea than it wouldn't be for us today.
So that wouldn't have been way, way out of bounds.
But the important thing for us is what does happen is this is a point which everyone's going to have to deal with, whether Roman Catholic, with the Counter-Reformation, with us, is how are we going to deal with this need for reform?
Right.
And this is what gives way to our unique reform in England. And thanks partly to Henry's conservatism in theological matters. Hmm. Henry was very Catholic.
Yeah, really. That's such an ironic.
He was very Catholic.
Yeah.
To the extent that he resisted moving away from the traditional roots of the church.
Uh-huh.
Very much so. So we have more of a balance in the English Reformation between the idea of maintaining our strong connection with the historic church,
mm-hmm.
but also with what's brought from the Continental Reformation, justification by faith, the emphasis on scripture, these kind of participation of the people.
Yeah.
This has very much become, so we end up, because of that, maybe starting out with Henry's conservatism,
mm-hmm.
but a genuine Reformation, we end up with sort of a unique place in the Reformation.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about that unique place. I mean, so what were the reforms in the English Reformation that became really central and crucial?
Well, we did completely adopt theologically the emphasis on Scripture. Mm-hmm. As being our sola scriptura, mind you, read by the church and the tradition in the sense of the undivided, the faith of the councils, the faith of the creeds. So, and justification, emphasizing justification by faith, but also one thing that was the idea of the priesthood of all believers, the active involvement of, for example, our emphasis on liturgy and the language. We say a language understanded of the people. Yeah. That's the actual word. Yeah. I love that.
English.
Is that we should worship in English.
Yeah.
And make things as easy for people to participate. So the Book of Common Prayer is a matter of taking all things that used to be in multiple different books,
mm-hmm.
is putting them all together in a very usable form, a very accessible form. In England, making sure a Bible was when Bibles were books were very expensive, mm-hmm. a Bible in every church in England, mm-hmm. in English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They'd have to chain them because of their value.
I see. Yeah.
So that anyone could consult. So these are the idea of the divine office, again, the morning and evening prayers. We had talked about another episode. Had become something you had to be professionally religious. The Latin and the complications and things.
Right.
A form that everybody really could and does use. We're very proud of that in our tradition.
Yeah.
Morning and evening prayer, part of our regular life of regular everyday Anglicans.
Yeah.
Not something, even in the Roman Church, they've tried in the Second Vatican Council to restore that.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, it's rare as a Roman Catholic who is not religious in the sense of a priest or a nun or a mm-hmm. brother who reads the divine office, they call it. In Anglicanism, it's a part of our common, is sort of restored as the prayer of the church
in the
broadest sense.
Yeah. Well, so explain one last thing to me before we go. So we come out of the Reformation with no longer recognizing, no longer being papists, I guess you'd say. That's always the word for it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's probably some nuances there. But, we in the Anglican Church don't have a pope. Can you explain the distinction there?
Well, something we share with the Eastern Church.
Yes, that's true.
The sense of the real question is what is the place of the Church of Rome and of the Bishop of Rome?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a way to look at it is this. I think we've talked, and when we talked about Ignatius of Antioch, I think we might have mentioned the fact that in the early church, one of the Church of Rome was very, very highly regarded mm-hmm. and consulted. But the primary reason we see it, we've talked about Irenaeus and the like, is that Peter and Paul were both there. And so when people are looking for examples of, you know, what do we have examples of really good practice? Uh-huh. But the idea of the special role of Peter as the keys of the kingdom being given to him is not really what we're talking. We're talking about here is it's the church of Peter and Paul.
Yeah.
But the idea that there was a unique authority of this church over other churches is certainly something that was never recognized. You know, a special role, a spokesman, perhaps, you know, mm-hmm. an organizer, but the idea that they would have a ruling role
okay.
over the other churches is simply was never accepted by the Eastern churches. That's sort of something that has developed over the centuries
okay.
and has become more and more pronounced. Remember, the doctrine of papal infallibility is something that dates only to the 19th century.
Right.
In its formal enunciation this way.
Sure.
So again, Henry and the English Church have never disclaimed the validity. They would say the Bishop of Rome is exactly that, the Bishop of Rome,
uh-huh.
of a very noble see of the Church. But the idea that he had any direct authority in England, another thing, for example, would put us together with the Orthodox, would be the idea of direct universal jurisdiction. Is we essentially believe all bishops share an equality.
Mm.
In the Roman Church, in the Roman Catholic Church, the Pope has this unique authority. He can directly intervene anywhere.
Yeah.
It's not just like an appellate court. He can
right.
directly intervene anywhere.
Yeah.
In the Orthodox world or in the Anglican world, the idea, no, every bishop, you know, bishops work together. We meet together synods or councils and things, but there is no one who is the real boss
mm-hmm,
who can
mm-hmm.
go in. We don't have that role. So we look upon that as an ongoing development in Rome.
And our archbishop would be simply kind of like a first among equals.
Yeah. A gatherer,
mm-hmm.
Symbolic, someone who can call things together, but he has no authority.
Uh-huh.
There
uh-huh.
is no structure. He doesn't set doctrine.
Sure.
That's where we have Lambeth conferences came from in Anglican churches when an issue did come up in South Africa over some practice in doctrine, is we got all the bishops together.
Yeah, yeah.
But the idea of this unique role, for example, in with the question of the Assumption of Mary, which is a doctrine which is only from the 1950s,
mm-hmm.
is the Pope sent a letter to the bishops around the world seeing if they had objections. He was going to announce this as a infallible.
Uh-huh.
And that's the kind of place we would be foreign to us. We don't see anyone having that kind of role. We have a deposit of faith. The bishops, each in their own diocese, share equal jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And when there's a problem that affects, what happens if something goes wrong? The church gets together.
Yeah.
All the bishops get together to deal with the common family problem.
Okay, yeah.
And why someone might be like, we had the Archbishop of Canterbury, someone might be used to bring us together. Is they aren't the settlers. We're not just advising that person
right,
who makes
right.
a decision.
Okay, yeah.
In Rome, that's really true. I mean, mm-hmm. the Pope essentially has the power to make any decision.
Yeah, yeah.
Even a council advises him, but he could overturn, you know, for us, you could call, but no one has that power.
Right, right, okay. And so this wouldn't have been, this wouldn't have been regarded as, you know, as sort of throwing off something that's always been around, but rather that we would be returning to something more like how the early church functioned and how the Eastern Church has always functioned.
Well, I would also say that what we look at the papacy today is very different even from the papacy at the time. Remember, we just came out of the Great Schism.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that there was no formal doctrine of infallibility and things, I think it's a mistake historically to project back today's papacy with those doctrines even back in the 16th century.
Yeah. So the papacy itself looked different?
Looked very different.
Okay.
It was a very important source of authority, but it certainly was not the infallible papacy
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of today. It's interesting that the term that actually was used by Henry VIII, I told you about he was very Catholic, was he refused to surrender the term Catholic to Roman Catholics.
Yeah,
he called them Pope Catholics. So taking another way, but to understand that he very much saw himself as, we are as Catholic as anyone else. We're the Catholic Church in England.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
like the Gallican Church was the Catholic Church in France, and mm-hmm. its incarnation in France was the Gallican Church.
Okay. Yeah. Well, great. Well, thanks, Father Stephen. That's all the time we have left for this episode. Again, we'll be talking more about Anglicanism, about our own tradition as
I should be surprised if we didn't receive a
one or a two letters. Or two. Hey, bring them on. Send them to wordtablepodcast@gmail.com. We're happy to receive all letters. And leave us a review. Leave us a little feedback if you have time on iTunes. And we will see you guys next week on Word and Table for more on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship. Thanks for listening.
And asleep rest.